Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 46th episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Saturday, the 22nd of February, 2014, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. This week's show is brought to you by the generous donation of Carl S. These donations really do help to keep the show humming along. So if you'd like to part with some of your hard-earned cash, what better way to set fire to it than by clicking on that there donate button on the podcast website. This week, our guest is Dr. William Paul Cockshott, a reader in the Computer Science Department of Glasgow University. Paul was first trained as an economist, then as a computer scientist, and he has made contributions to the fields of image compression, 3D television, and parallel compilers. He is also known for his work in applying econophysics to classical economics, the field of economic computability, and as the co-author of the book Towards a New Socialism, advocating for a more efficient and democratic planning of a complex economy. In this show, we discuss the origins of classical political economy and how it was influenced by the rapid advances in the world of physics. We talk of the importance of Watt and his steam engine, the development of the theories of thermodynamics and entropy, and their importance in the economy. We also discuss the work of Charles Babbage and Alan Turing's universal computer, and why man is really the universal robot. We also discuss the overwhelming empirical evidence for Marx's labour theory of value, why it is that it works, and how the work of previous guest Professor Gregory Chaitin plays a role in today's modern factory. We join the conversation as the good doctor is trying to explain how in God's name he managed to link all this stuff together.
These ideas came to me really when I was looking at the distinction that Marx made between labour and labour power. I'll explain what he meant by the distinction. He had this problem of explaining how it was that on the one hand, all sales on the market could be treated as fair and equal exchanges, and yet the end result of these fair and equal exchanges was to produce something whereby one group of people got immensely wealthy at the expense of another group. And how did this come about? By fair and equal exchange. Now, there would be two possible ways you could solve that. One would be to say that workers were cheated of the value of their labour. We're only paid part of the value of the labour because the market is rigged in such a way that they can never sell it for the full value. The alternative would be, if you're doing what Marx was doing, which was an imminent critique of political economy in terms of the concepts of the political economists themselves, he says, okay, well, how can you have a situation where it appears that the labourer is paid a fair price for his labour, which is the price, according to Ricardo, that's necessary to maintain and reproduce the labouring class. And at the same time, there is profit and exploitation. And he says, well, what's actually happening is that people are not being paid for their work. They're being paid for their ability to work. If a self-employed craftsman makes something and sells it on the market, he sells the product of his labour directly. But if someone is employed in a cotton mill to spin cotton, they don't sell the product of their labour. What they're selling is their ability to work. And the amount of work that the employer can get out of them per day is a variable quantity. And of course, characteristic of the period Marx was writing was that working hours were extremely long, had been progressively extended by the factory system, so that what was being sold was the ability to do labour, but the amount of labour that the employer got out of that could be quite a lot more according to the conditions of labour. Now, it occurred to me that you couldn't really make that distinction between labour itself and ability to do labour unless society had prepared you for those kinds of concepts. And where did these concepts actually come from? They actually came from the start of the Industrial Revolution when Watt is producing steam engines. Now, Watt didn't invent the steam engine. He was set the task of repairing a Newcomb engine, a model Newcomb engine, when he was a technician at Glasgow University.
So these Newcomb engines were used mainly in mines for pumping water, is that right?
They were used for pumping. They had no rotary motion. They were purely pumping engines. And Watt looked at this, and because he'd been working along with Black on the nature of heat, he realized that, in fact, these Newcomb engines were very inefficient. They threw away heat. They repeatedly cooled the piston down by condensing the steam in the piston by spraying water into it. And therefore, a lot of the heat was wasted. So what Watt actually did was to invent the separate condenser, whereby the heat was removed from the steam in a separate vessel. And he invented a series of valves, automatic valves, which let the steam through from the piston into the condenser, or let steam into the other side of the piston. And this led to a great improvement in the efficiency of steam engines. Now, these steam engines were hired out by Watt's company, and he promised to hire them out for less than the saving in coal people would have made if they used a Newcomb engine. But in order to do that, he needed to have some way of measuring how much work these engines were doing and rating their power. So he became the first person to systematically study the amount of work that a horse could do and introduce the concept of a horsepower. And in doing that, he was the first person to make the distinction between the ability to do work, which is the power of the horse, and the actual work that's done. Now, for Watt, work was purely labor, purely effort, the effort of a horse or the effort of a person hauling up weights, physical exertion of effort. And when you think of society in the late 18th century, that is a very reasonable assessment of what work was, because most work was the physical exertion of human muscle, and that was what people were being paid to do. Most of it was heavy physical work. In Adam Smith, this identity of physical effort with labor is such that Smith can talk about a farmer having his laboring servants and his laboring horses, because they're both seen as doing the same thing. So that what Watt is promising is he's promising people power, the ability to do work with his machines. And by this, he's going to transform the wealth of society. And in a real sense, he does, because the power of his machines within a few decades are turning out more effort than all the muscle power of the human beings and horses in the kingdom. So that from that point of view, he's caught a key aspect of labor and of power. And that concept is still very much present in the classical political economists. I was saying how Smith says that labor is the original currency by which we win things from nature. And he also talks of labor as something both animals and humans do.
So he doesn't differentiate between the two types of labor?
Well, they're both seen in that society as labor. Now, he knows that animals aren't skilled and there's a limit to the labor they can do. They can't participate in the division of labor. Smith is also interested in why are things valuable? And he quickly disposes of the idea it's because they're useful, because he points out there's lots of valuable things which aren't particularly useful. And the only thing that you consistently find is that things which are valuable require a lot of work to make them. But what I'm saying is at that point in time, at the dawn of the industrial age, when most labor was physical labor, the distinction between the labour that Watt was researching at Glasgow University and Smith was researching at Glasgow University at the same time was not clear. They're both dealing with work. Smith is dealing with how work can be made more efficient by subdividing labour and specialising labour. And Watt is looking at how work can be replaced by artificial sources of power.
So in essence, then, as the steam engine becomes an important driver of the economy, we start to see the split between the idea of the work of an engine or an animal and the work of a human.
Yes, it becomes more evident later on. What's striking in The Wealth of Nations is that Smith doesn't discuss the use of powered machinery. All his economic improvements come through the subdivision of labour so that people can complete their tasks quicker. So that by doing the same task again and again, they become more skilled at it, their movements become more automatic, and they don't lose the time switching between tasks, and thereby more is produced. But this vision of production is still a pre-industrial one because powered industry didn't exist at that point. I mean, you had water mills. You'd had water mills since Roman times, but they were the exception. Apart from the production of flour, mass production wasn't generally based on powered machinery.
So where does Marx come into this with his labour theory of value?
Well, he takes the labour theory of value over from Smith and makes it more precise in some ways, because Smith confuses how much labour you can purchase with how much labour was required to make something. And he treats these as the same thing. And in a pre-industrial society of handicrafts and farmers, they are the same thing. That when a Scottish farmer put his grain on sale and bought in return some produce from the blacksmith, the value of his corn could be expressed in terms of how much other people's labour he could command with it. And he was directly commanding the labour of other tradesmen. So that this idea that the value is how much labour you can command has an intuitive appeal in a pre-capitalist or only partially capitalist society. But obviously once capitalism becomes general, it's not the same thing, because wages only make up a part of the value of what's sold. So that although something may contain a certain amount of labour, the employer hasn't had to pay that much to his workers. So that the thing actually commands more labour than it contains.
This is a unique property to labour.
Let's say for the moment it is. I'll qualify that. This distinction between labour commanded and labour embodied was pointed out by Ricardo. And Ricardo is writing after the introduction of capitalist machinery is becoming much more common in the early 19th century. So these things, which were not apparent in the mid-18th century, were quite apparent by the early 19th century. And Marx is basing himself on this distinction that Ricardo makes, but is trying to explain how it's still possible that everything sells for its value, and yet you get exploitation. His explanation is based on this concept of the distinction between power and work done, which I'm saying he essentially takes from Watt. Now, you ask the question, is this only a property of labour? Well, it's a property of whatever you take to be the value substance. Suppose you take the British economy, and instead of trying to calculate the labour value of all the main products of the main industries, you choose to say, okay, we will treat oil as the substance of value, okay? And we will say the value of each product is the amount of oil, number of barrels of oil, that has to be directly or indirectly used to make that product. Now, for gasoline, that's relatively simple. Plastics are also going to involve oil going into their production. But you then go to something like a TV set, and a TV set is going to require oil to have been burnt to provide the energy to transport it, oil being burnt to provide the energy to manufacture the parts, and then in addition it'll have oil going into the plastics which make up the frame of it. And you can systematically do this. If you use the input-output tables, you can work out how much oil goes into everything. And then you find you have to say, what is the value of oil itself? Well, if you're going to be consistent, you would say it's the amount of oil required to produce it. But what do you discover? You discover that it takes less than one barrel of oil, directly or indirectly, to produce a barrel of oil. So that you find, if you took that definition, you would find that oil ended up, after one attempt of your calculations, you'd find that the value of oil was not one full barrel, but maybe a third of a barrel of oil has to be used to make a barrel of oil. So the value of everything would just suddenly drop by a third. Next time you attempt to calculate it, again, it drops further. The point is that whatever commodity you take to be your value substance in a functioning economy always requires less than one unit of the substance to make one unit of it. So it's a property of saying something is the value substance that you have to make that distinction.
Does this only work for power generating commodities?
No, you can do it for steel. It's obviously you have to take sort of basic commodities, which are ones which directly or indirectly are used in the production of everything else. And there's a certain number of these basic commodities. Not all commodities are basic in that sense, but in what Marx called sector one of the economy, these products are used directly or indirectly to make everything else. And you could, in principle, choose any one of those and say this is the substance of value. And you could get a consistent theory of value from that. The question is, would it be empirically accurate in predicting prices? And when you try investigating it, you find that energy theories of value or oil theories of value or steel theories of value give a much poorer prediction of actual prices than the labor theory of value. So although in principle you could make that distinction for any commodity, it actually turns out that the only one that empirically makes sense is labor.
Why is it then that workers haven't gone the way of the horses? Why do we still have workers and we don't have workhorses anymore in the economy?
Well, it comes down to the fact that there is more to work than just muscular energy. Where it's just muscular energy, it's not too difficult to replace it by machinery. So horses got replaced very quickly. And somewhat later, the heavy labor of the navvies who dug the railways got replaced by the work of earth moving machines and diggers of one sort or another. Now, that only occurs when the wages rise enough for it to be worth using these machines, but once it's worth doing it, they can be replaced. The difference is between a human being and a horse is that a horse can only pull. You can't set a horse to spin. You can't set a horse to tend the sails of a ship. Whereas human beings can be set to almost any laboring task. They may not be terribly strong at it, but they're adaptable. And it's this adaptability which must be a fundamental reason why we're the dominant species. Now, the way I say it is that we are the universal robots. And that's, of course, a bit of a pun, because the term robot in English comes from Capek's play, Rossum's Universal Robots, which it was written in the 30s and involves this English inventor, Rossum, who comes to Prague and sets up a factory making mechanical men who are universal robots. And of course, robot in the Slavic language just means workers. And these universal robots really did represent a threat to humans because they could do any job that a human could do.
So if we had an android like Data from Star Trek, who was much better than a human at all these different tasks, if there was enough of Data type beings out there doing work, we should see the value of everything drop tremendously, because they would be the new essential universal robot.
Yes. And they would present that would be a real existential threat to human beings, because at that point, the wealthy would see no point in maintaining a labouring population. And if they, in countries where they remained in control, one hates to think what would happen.
We are programmed just to do anything you want us to. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots.
Bear in mind that this is something that novelists have not been slow to point out, that if robots were really capable of replacing human beings in all kinds of tasks, they would have to have as complex an internal life as we do. And in Philip K. Dick's novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was turned into Blade Runner, he's essentially making the point that the androids would rebel. They would have the same motivations as human workers if they had the same capabilities.
So Marx had a different idea for why humans were the source of all value.
Well, the ideas that people form are obviously shaped by the technologies they grow up with. I mean, the idea of a robot wasn't there in his day. And to my mind, the distinctions he makes are ones which don't hold up in terms of modern science. He says that the distinction between human labor and what animals do is that the humans form a plan and have a vision of what they're going to achieve before they do it. And this kind of sharp distinction between the activity of humans and the activity of animals, I don't think can be sustained in the light of, it couldn't be sustained even in the light of Darwin's writings, but it certainly can't be sustained in the light of modern science, because the tool used by animals is now well documented. It's difficult to say that animals don't consciously plan actions or don't consciously have an intention in mind. If you think of a wolf pack dividing their tasks up so that some will chase the deer and others will ambush it, this is intentional behavior. They may not be able to talk, but they communicate and carry out intentional behavior. So that hard and fast distinction between humans and animals on that basis, I don't think is sustainable. What is sustainable is that humans are able to formulate and materialize plans for activity. They can record and write them down. They can record them in language, which is then memorized, and they can write them down in symbols. And it's the ability to do that which allows a much more complex division of labor, which is non-instinctive in human societies. Obviously, the social insects have got a complex division of labor, and Marx recognizes that. He says that bees put many architects to shame. But he says bees never form an image of what they're intending to do. Well, that may be true, that bees don't form an image of what they're intending to do. And he gives another example of the spider, which says puts spinners to shame. But recent experimental work does indicate that spiders are able to form plans. Work involved placing spiders on top of pencils in a three-dimensional space in an enclosed bottle where there's another something they want, an insect or something, on the top of another pencil, and they form a strategy of how to get there. And people now think that in order to build a web, they're behaving intentionally. That kind of distinction between humans and animals on that basis is not sustainable. And it's not even sustainable to say that only humans have culture, because we know that certain forms of tool use in apes and macaques is cultural. And we know that certain different groups of whales have local cultures, different distinct ways of hunting and cooperating. So that these are not the key distinctions. I think the key distinctions are the flexibility we get through having hands and the fact that we can also communicate plans to one another via language. There's no other species on Earth at present which combines those traits. There are species which appear to be able to communicate. I mean, whales and porpoises appear to be able to do that and collaborate, but they don't have hands. And there are species with hands, but they don't have the language we have.
As an analogy for the universal robot idea behind value, in the world of computer science, we have a similar idea put forward by the work of Alan Turing.
Yes. Now, he at first introduces the idea of the universal computer as a machine that is capable of doing any mathematical operation that a human mathematician can do. And it's worth looking at how he analyzes what a human mathematician does. Because mathematics in his day was taken to be the most abstract and most rational type of human activity, something uniquely human at that point. And he's saying, basically, if you're going to do a calculation, and he's talking about people typically doing real calculations, working with numbers, you've got squared paper, you write numbers down, and you do things like adding them up or multiplying them. And when you're doing that, you're always just looking at a small area of the sheet of paper, and you're concentrating on, for example, the column of digits that you're adding up. And you're remembering in your mind a small running total, and every time it runs over 10, you write a little 1 next to the next column of digits, if you recall how you're taught to do it at school. So what he's saying is that all mathematics comes down to the mathematician being able to see a certain number of symbols at once, having a certain state of mind, and on the basis of that state of mind, writing down new symbols, or possibly, if he's got a rubber, rubbing something out. And therefore he says, suppose I build a machine that can do the same thing, okay? That it's got a tape, so he makes it, instead of a squared sheet of paper, he makes it a long strip of paper with squares on it. And the machine can write numbers down in that, and the machine is aware of the current number, and it's aware of what state of mind it's in. And on the basis of looking at the current number and the state of mind it's in, it writes another number down, or moves the tape left or right, and changes its state of mind. And he says, okay, with this very simple set machine, I capture the essence of what a mathematician is able to do. And from that, I can build a universal machine. Now, the universal machine is slightly different from just that abstract particular Turing machine, in that it's a Turing machine that can be given instructions that enable it to emulate any other Turing machine. And this universal machine can therefore, in principle, given the right program, solve any mathematical problem. That was what Turing's goal was when he started work on trying to develop a practical universal computer after the war. His goal was to have a machine that could solve any mathematical problem. Now, obviously, he wasn't the first person to have thought of that. I mean, the same basic idea had occurred to Babbage in the early 19th century. He said that if he had a machine of a certain degree of complexity, he suddenly realized it could solve any mathematical problem. So it's not, Turing wasn't the first person to do it, but he expressed it more clearly than anyone else. And it's interesting that his idea of the universal machine is published the same year that Carol Capek's play is put on the BBC. So it's, the idea of a universal robot, the universal machine, was part of the concepts of the day. And Turing is applying it specifically in a mathematical context. Now, we know that he succeeded. He came up with designs which later generalized. And we have these machines. We're carrying out our conversation using it. And the thing about these machines is that they're not like all previous machines. Previous machines were built to achieve one given task, whereas computers can be applied to any information processing task. Given sufficient time, they'll solve it. That has all sorts of economies, because it means only one design of computer needs to be settled on and it can be mass produced. So to that extent, this universality in information processing has been achieved by machinery. But they're disembodied intelligences, and they're fairly limited intelligences at the moment. I mean, I'm working with colleagues on developing a cloth folding robot, and it's an extraordinarily difficult task, even to do the things we do easily, like picking up and folding clothes. It's extraordinarily difficult to get a robot such that it sees a jumble of clothes and can decide where is the right place to pick it up. Things that we find absolutely easy, the automatic hand-eye coordination that we have, is extraordinarily time-consuming and complicated to express mathematically. So we're still a long way from being able to do all sorts of things which are trivial human labor tasks. Now, practically, if you've got a laundry, a hospital laundry, there will be specialized machines which are very good at folding clothes up. They don't have general intelligence. They're a machine which will really fold clothes up very fast, faster than the human being. And they do it by laying the clothes out and having various flaps which come over to flap over the arms, you know, of a shirt into position, etc. That special purpose, classical industrial mechanical engineering, is not yet universal robotics. But the engineering science of robotics is advancing at an extraordinary rate at the moment. There are robot animals, robot dogs, robot ponies, and various other animals, which have been made by the robot lab, I think at MIT, sorry, at Boston, that can walk through the woods, run through the woods, with the kind of gait that animals have. So the things which have been most difficult are the things which seem the easy things, the non-rational things, the ease of movement in our body, that kind of thing. It's only very recently that people are able to get robots that are capable of doing it. Our cloth folding robot weighs a ton and is screwed to a concrete floor on the seventh floor of a building, which we had to specially reinforce to take it. So it's a long way from something that could be hired to walk into any workplace.
So Turing's universal computer, it's also used to measure the speed of any algorithm.
Yeah. I mean, just as you can use hours of labor of a standard skill level to determine the value of things, in computing, in principle, you measure the complexity of any algorithm by the number of cycles a Turing machine it would take. No one actually uses a Turing machine because they are relatively inefficient. And it's an active research topic at the moment to see how the number of cycles of one type of machine and the length of programs you need for machines vary according to the semantic power of the machines. These things are not properly understood yet. But in principle, we know that any computation that can be done on any other machine can be done on a universal Turing machine. And subject to some efficiency factor, the complexity of these different calculations is equivalent. Well, that's one of the strong hypotheses of computer science. It's not proven, but a strongly accepted hypothesis. Saying where does thermodynamics come from? Essentially, it starts with the attempt by Watt to improve the efficiency of steam engines. So there's therefore already in Watt the realization that heat is being converted into work, and that the more efficient your conversion of heat into work, the better the efficiency of your steam engine. This is then shown by Carnot that there are ultimately a maximum efficiency a heat engine can achieve. In any heat engine, the efficiency is related to the temperature difference between the input heat and the output heat. And then you start getting, in Clausius, the formation of laws of thermodynamics saying that heat always goes from a body of high temperature to low temperature, that you can't convert heat with complete efficiency into work, whereas Joule shows you can convert work back into heat, so that there is an irreversibility to processes, thermodynamic processes. Then later on in the, I have to go forward to the 40s now, when a telephone engineer working for Bell Laboratories in the States is trying to quantify the information carrying capacity of telephone wires. And here we see something very similar to Watt. Watt is trying to quantify something which is an everyday concept, the concept of work. And he gives it a scientific meaning. And information, obviously, was an everyday concept prior to Shannon. But once you have to say, how can we measure it? You have to give it a rigorous definition. And Shannon is able to give the information content of telephone messages or telex messages a rigorous definition in terms of probability theory. And when you work through the maths of the probability theory, you come up with what's effectively the same formula as Boltzmann came up with when he was trying to formulate the laws of thermodynamics in terms of molecular motions and probability of movement of molecules. Shannon then realizes that information and entropy are the same thing. And this is paradoxical because people think that information is the opposite of entropy. But what Shannon shows is that the transmission of information along a digital signal is maximized as that stream of bits becomes indistinguishable from random numbers, from random noise. The further away it is from random noise, the more redundant the encoding is, the less efficient it is at transmitting information. So this is it's a fundamental, huge transformation of the way people thought of information. If you read people's commentary in the 50s, a lot of people don't still understand it in the 50s. Nowadays, if you're working on information theory as working on data compression or video compression, you treat them as the same thing. Entropy and information are essentially the same thing.
So entropy is the idea of disorder versus order.
Yes.
So if you have a cup of coffee in a room, say, for example, which is hot, over time it will become the same temperature as the entire room. So it's more disordered. The heat is dissipated.
The heat is dissipated. Basically, Boltzmann is saying, okay, what is the probability of getting something, a given state? And a state where all the heat is in the coffee cup is less probable than one where it's being spread around the room, because there are a lot more different ways the thermal energy can be carried by all the gas molecules in the room than there are ways in which it can be carried just in the coffee cup. So that over time, the system will move to a more probable state, which is the heat spread across. It's from that the maths comes out, which gives you the same formula as Shannon used.
And so for Shannon's idea was then that if you send a message down a wire, say I'm talking and I keep on saying perhaps the words the and, that it's not very efficient, that we could express it and crunch it down into a smaller piece.
Yes, this was recognized even by Samuel Morse. So when he devises his Morse code, he uses a shorter series of dots and dashes for frequently used letters than for less frequently used letters. And in general, if you are transmitting video data and you watch something from YouTube, that's exactly what's being done. The frequently occurring patterns in a scene can be sent with fewer bits than the more rarely occurring patterns.
How does this understanding of entropy then link into our economic productive processes?
Well, you then have to go one more step further, I think, in the development and the understanding of it, which is in the 60s, when Chaitin was a young man, he was working on the problem of what do we mean by a random number? And in Russia at the same time, Kolmogorov was working on that. And both of them came up with the idea that a number is random if there's no formula shorter than that, which we can generate that sequence of numbers. And Chaitin later formalized this in saying a sequence of numbers is random if there is no Turing machine program shorter than that sequence of numbers, which will print it out. And this gives another definition of the information content of something. Because when Shannon's talking about information content and entropy, he's talking about it in terms of probability theory. Now, Chaitin gives you a different non-probabilistic definition of information, which is based just on how few bits do you need to print this information out. And the shortest number of bits that you need to print it out on a computer is the information content of that. So, for example, he says pi has got a sequence of digits which go on forever. But in fact, quite a small program, you set it going and it'll go on printing out pi. So although these digits in pi are unpredictable unless you compute pi out, the actual information content of it is just set by the length of the computer program which prints it.
So it's a very deep idea.
Yes. It's related to what is the nature of randomness and what is the nature of information. Now, if you start looking then at industrial production, you see that a whole series of revolutions in industrial production have occurred through information economies. And if we take one of the first ones, it's the invention of the potter's wheel. The potter's wheel enables the mass production of round pots. Why? Because a round thing has got low information content. All you need to do is specify the radius, because that radius is shared by all points on the circumference of the pot. And the potter specifies the radius between his finger and his thumb, or between her finger and her thumb, as the pot is spun. And you therefore are using a small amount of information to shape the whole pot.
So it's much easier when it's already spinning. You just put your finger at one simple point. It's only one number, and that will define how the pot will look.
Yes. If you don't have a potter's wheel, you have to go all the way around, squishing it into shape, and you don't get it perfectly round, and it takes you much longer. Now, there's a whole series of classic industrial techniques which all depend on spinning things round. So that things turned on a lathe are obviously the other main example of that. Now, another economy which transformed things, economy of information which transformed things, was if you can simultaneously apply information at right angles to the thing that you're shaping. And there are two historical industries from a long, long time ago where this type of technique is employed for mass production. The first one I knew of was the Samian ware industry of Gaul, where in the Roman Gaul, they mass produced high quality pottery with molded surfaces. So it has all sorts of satyrs and gods and things like that on the surface. And that's done by making a mold into which you pour the clay before it's completely hardened. And unlike the potter's wheel, you're actually able to convey a lot more information to it and get something much more elaborate.
So instead of one point, which is the expression of the width of the pot that you do with your finger, you've got many different artistic things that can be put onto this one mold and then copied.
Yeah, you can use the mold repeatedly. So the human labor is initially used in carving the mold, and then the mold transfers that information that's taken the human a long time to produce onto many, many pots. Another example of that very early on is the trigger mechanisms of crossbows that the Qin Empire used. They're mass-produced, standardized trigger mechanisms. I remember being astonished when I saw a couple of samples from the Emperor's tomb with the porcelain warriors. What astonished me was the quality of the metalwork, the quality of the bronze sword and the quality of the metalwork in the crossbows. And these are mass-produced, again using molds to standardize the size and shape. So we then come forward to Babbage. After Adam Smith, Babbage, the economist, who's really concerned about the basis of industrial productivity. Smith was concerned about it and explained it in terms of the division of labor. Babbage actually had a much, much better engineering knowledge than Smith. And in his book, The Political Economy of Machinery and Manufacture, he identifies other principles than just the simple division of labor, which lead to increase in production. And the techniques of copying he identifies as absolutely being a key one. Now, let's take another industry which produced a huge transformation, which was the printing industry. Now, if we analyze that in terms of information theory and entropy, what you start off with is just random cellulose fibers, which are in a mush, and they're completely disordered. And you boil it up, and then you roll it out to form paper. And this process of rolling it out is a process of reducing the entropy of the material. It has fewer degrees of freedom. Fibers in paper are forced to be aligned with the surface of the paper and therefore have fewer degrees of freedom.
So there's less randomness in it. It's more ordered, and the entropy is lower because it's ordered.
There's less randomness in it. It's more ordered. And having produced a low entropy material, you can then add human information to it. You reduce the natural information in it, and you replace it with human information when you bring down the printing head and write letters on it. This printing head coming down is the same technology as is used in molding.
So the printer head comes down and it puts maybe a dye into the paper, and now the paper is more disordered between white and black, and maybe it puts an indent in it and it's more compressed in one place than another. So now we've got more disorder in that paper.
Yes. There's a story by Borges about the ultimate library. And the ultimate library is a library where every possible book exists. Every possible book is every possible permutation of letters. And obviously the great bulk of those mean nothing, but some of them mean something. Now, there's a huge number of possible permutations of letters that a printer can put on a paper, but he puts one particular combination, which is a human chosen combination. So if you look at a lot of manufacturing processes, they start out by reducing the entropy of a material, and then they add some kind of human chosen information to it. It's the same process that takes place to make a car. A lot of energy has to be used to reduce the entropy of iron ore to make iron. And more work is then done to reduce the entropy of a large block of iron and turn it into a flat rolled sheet. Given sheet iron, which could be pressed into any shape, or sheet steel, which could be pressed into any shape, a particular die will force it into a car door shape. It is doing the same thing as the Samian wear does. It's conveying information in parallel. And if we look at the mass production industries, they are dominated by industries which are able to transfer human-generated information in parallel at right angles onto the substance. The industry which has obviously had the hugest improvement in that is the semiconductor industry. which is essentially a printing industry, a microprinting industry.
Again and again, in when we look at the modern factory, we have this idea of getting raw materials and commodities and increasing the order, so decreasing the entropy, and then putting our own information, which physically will, again, increase the entropy. So we use energy and labor to reduce the entropy, and then we do it again to increase the entropy, but with a task in mind.
Towards a particular goal, yes. And to replicate it, typically, to make millions of copies of the same thing.
So in the lecture I saw you talk about this before, you tied Chaitin's theory of algorithmic information theory back to this process.
Yes, I mean, essentially, it becomes very evident once you've digitized production. If you are printing something, you actually know how many bits you have to send to the laser printer to print the information. Take different ways of types of laser printers. First generation laser printers, you had to send every bit to the laser printer at 300 dots per inch. You had to switch it on and off, on and off, on and off. Then Adobe come along and they invent PostScript. What PostScript does is essentially turns your laser printer into a Turing machine, or turns it into a stack machine. And what you send to it is a PostScript program, which then prints your image. So every time you use a Adobe PostScript laser printer, you're applying Chaitin's theorem. You're sending less information because you're sending a program which prints the whole thing.
As an inventor, Wayne Szalinski was used to striking out.
Come on, drink.
But now, it's a whole new ball game.
The machine works. Do the kids know?
Well, yeah, the kids know.
That's great.
No, it's not that great.
Why?
I shrunk the kids. They're in the backyard.
What?
Threw them out with the trash.
It's a jungle out there.
From the Disney Studios starring Rick Moranis.
Are you saying that machine
blew up my kid?
Oh, no.
The machine had blown up the kids. There'd be pieces of them everywhere.
What is the empirical evidence then that backs up, or does the empirical evidence support Marx's labor theory of value? And what does normal economics think about labor theory of value?
Non-Marxist economics pays no attention to it, doesn't believe it's true at all, and doesn't take it seriously. But it's actually very well empirically supported, in that if you look at almost any country and you compute the amount of labor required to produce the output of every industry. Okay? And then you see by how much does the output of that industry sell. You'll find that for the country, that there's above a 95% correlation coefficient between those two. Which means that 95% of the variation in prices of output of the industries, or the value of the output of the industry, is determined by the amount of labor required to produce that output.
That's a very strong result.
It is. It's extraordinarily strong, yes. There are not many pieces of economics which are so well attested. I mean, the classical economists like Smith and Ricardo took it as so obvious that they didn't need to produce the evidence. When neoclassical economics replaced classical economics as the dominant theory, they didn't actually produce any empirical evidence against the labor theory of value. They constructed an abstract, non-empirical set of mathematical theories, which they claimed would explain how prices operated. But they're actually non-testable set of theories, because they've got more free variables than things you can observe. And if you've got a theory with more free variables than observations, by twiddling the free variables, you can explain anything. And your theory explains nothing because it explains everything. This is Chaitin's point again. Scientific theories have to have information economy. They have to predict more than the content of the theory.
The idea of Occam's razor, the shorter the explanation, the more concise it is, the more, in some sense, correct that theory is.
Yes. And basically, neoclassical theory has no predictions of the overall price structure of an economy.
Well, I think we've covered loads of stuff. Is there anything that we've left out?
Well, there is something else which I haven't talked about, which is, why does the labour theory of value hold? I mean, you can empirically observe that it holds. You can make analogies between human labour and energy, as Marx did. But that doesn't explain why it is that it's labour that determines the value of things. Now, one clue to it is to say, OK, it's human beings are the only universal resource we have. But another theory was put forward by two mathematicians in the 80s, and essentially they used a statistical mechanics argument to show that if you make certain quite plausible assumptions about the probability of a firm surviving if the price it obtains for its product is less than what they call the integrated labor coefficient of that product, which means, suppose you are making biscuits, okay? And suppose they're chocolate digestives. And a certain amount of labor is required to make the chocolate digestive. And that wages have to be paid for that. And wages have to be paid for the labor that goes into supplying the chocolate, labor has to that goes into supplying the flour, etc. Now, you can go back and see how much was labor was paid all the way back to the farmer on these things. How much was paid for labor? And they say, suppose a firm is only able to sell chocolate digestive biscuits for less than all the wages that were paid all the way back the supply chain. Well, it's clear it's very unlikely that firm will remain in business for long, because not only is it making a loss on its own account, but it's not even able to meet the wage bills of the previous layers of the manufacturing process. So they said, okay, let's assume that only 5%, or I can't remember what percentage of firms can be operating in that position. Then say, okay, let's assume, make a parsimonious assumption and assume that the ratio of actual prices to labor content is normally distributed. And if it's normally distributed and there is only a certain percentage of firms can be in this position where they're selling it at such a low price, then you can say we've constrained the normal distribution. We've constrained the normal distribution to have a certain standard deviation. On that basis, they make a prediction about the standard deviation of the ratios of values to prices. And they say, okay, it must be narrowly distributed. And that's actually what you find out. Any system with a large number of free variables, which are added together to produce an effect, ends up being normally distributed, okay? And that's just a property of probabilities. So that a random system, an entropic system, will have a normal distribution. Now, if we just assume that, and we make the additional constraint that firms can't remain solvent if they can't meet their costs, have a low probability of surviving, that is enough to generate the labor theory of value.
So that's a very deep result.
Yes, it's a very strong result.
Thanks very much for coming on the show today, Paul.
What's the show called, by the way?
I don't want to hear it. No more fussing and fighting, baby. Hold me tight.
Let's let on this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters by Sun Ra and his orchestra, The Robots of Kraftwerk, and Pink Floyd's Welcome to the Machine.
I was just a fool, too blind to see. You were the only girl for me.
You also heard Rick Moranis in the trailer for the 1980s classic Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And you're now listening to Johnny Nash singing Hold Me Tight. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega.
I know I was wrong.
just a fool, too blind to see. You were the only girl for me. Oh, but now I see the light. Everything's gonna be alright, baby. Hold me tight, girl, you know I.